This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome. Thank you for being here. Let me tell you why you should stick around. Let's get right to that. Oliver McIrwin is the amazing guest today. And here's why you should listen. Because Oliver had a show at Ace Gallery in Los Angeles right out of graduate school. For those of you not familiar, Ace Gallery is one of the, probably now, the oldest serious contemporary gallery in LA. And it's got two huge spaces to this day, one in Beverly Hills, one in Mid-Wilshire. And so Oliver had a show there right out of graduate school. And through a series of events that emanated from that show, went on to a career as an engineer, which he still is. And so you hear all about that. It's a great story. And in fact, Oliver told me since we had that conversation that having that conversation gave him some closure to that story in a way that he hadn't had before. So you get to partake of that, and I think you're going to enjoy it. Now let's just get out of the way some news and support information, and then that way we can listen to the whole episode uninterrupted. So first of all, I just want to let you know that we are heading back towards a schedule that is more regular. I know it's been very sporadic, and that's not a good thing for you as listeners. So I want to bring you back, and I want to do that by having, if not weekly episodes, at least a couple a month. And I think we're heading in that direction. So be prepared. Consider this a friendly warning for that. And in addition to that, I want to remind you that this show appreciates and needs support, including financial support. And there are other ways you can support the show as well. So let me just tell you what those are real quickly, and we can get to the podcast with Oliver. So first and best way that you can support the show is you can donate straight to PayPal through the website, theconversationpod.com. Go there, and if you have not already contributed something to the show, it would be very much appreciated. It means a lot to the show, to me, and I think it will feel good for you. So if you could do that, that would be awesome. You can also support the show by contributing to our supporters. And they are Made With Color at madewithcolor.com, the DIY website building platform that is specifically designed for artists looking to put up websites. So go check out madewithcolor.com. And if you use the promo code Conversation, all lowercase, you will get 29% off your first year. So go check out madewithcolor.com, great website building platform. And our second supporter is NatureBox. You may have heard about NatureBox from a prior episode. NatureBox is a healthy snack delivered to your door service as little as $20 a month. No high fructose corn syrup, no additives, preservatives, very gourmet, but also very tasty. Everything from sweet to savory to spicy. Over 100 options to choose from. If you go to theconversationpod.com and click on any of the links on the various pages, including the contact and about page and the homepage, you will go to NatureBox. And if you join, if you sign up initially, I believe you get 50% off your first order. So that's another great way to contribute and get something back in return. I get a little kickback from any joining member. Additionally, you can support the show by writing a nice review on iTunes. Again, linked through theconversationpod.com. Very few people have actually gone and written reviews for the show. I know it takes a leap of motivation, but if you could go ahead and do that, if you haven't yet, say something nice. If you listen to the show and appreciate it, that would be great. Thank you in advance for that. And finally, you can also support the show by following on Facebook and Twitter. Both of those links also through theconversationpod.com. Finally, going off of the prior episode where I asked for feedback on the format going forward of the show, I got a sort of a half and half mixed response. Many of the listeners of the show, as like you right now, are listening in their studios, and they are happy to listen to hour and a half, even longer episodes. I think others prefer something a little more modest, like anywhere from a half hour to maybe an hour max. So I would appreciate more of your feedback. More people weighing in on that will help me shape the way I think about episode, putting together episodes going forward. So just shoot me an email through the website. I would appreciate it. I think that's about it. I want to thank you for being here and sticking around for Oliver McIrwin, who I know you probably have not heard of, but you're going to really appreciate having listened to his story. So let's go listen to Oliver McIrwin. And thanks again, and I'll talk to you next time. So Oliver McIrwin, right?
That's right.
Artist, engineer. What other titles? Former musician.
What other titles is interesting? Because my name used to be Oliver Irwin, but I combined my last name with my wife. So
what's your wife's last name?
It used to be McCaffrey, and so.
And what's her last name now?
McIrwin.
Right, right. You're both McIrwins.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So there really is a method to the madness. So when people see your name, Oliver McIrwin, they go, oh, wow, that's crazy. And now we know why
people,
it's crazy.
Right. Certain people have been like, did you change your, like, what's this McIrwin?
And, right.
Yeah.
So speaking of your name, I think that's a really good segue to point out, thank you everybody for being here to listen to Oliver McIrwin's interview, conversation. I don't like to call them interviews because a lot of people are not going to know who you are.
Right.
And what's interesting, among other things about your story, is that you showed with Ace Gallery very young and had kind of an interesting experience, which we're going to talk about. So it was 1999
that
you had a show there. How long were you just out of grad school?
Yeah, I was.
Where did you go?
So I went to Claremont Graduate School, and there was a number of professors there that showed with Doug and
David Amico,
and I think Roland Reese had shown with him, and who else?
What's the other painter? John Millay.
John Millay shows with him. That's right. Yeah.
Did you have all those guys as teachers?
Yeah, they were, and they're all great. And then also I was Tim Hawkinson was kind of a like mentor to me.
Was he teaching at Claremont at the time?
No, he doesn't teach. I actually was in undergrad, and I hadn't even seen his work. I'd only seen a review, and I really liked the images. And I called 411 and got his number, and called him and said, "Hey, I'm a young artist. I'm looking to work for another artist, and would you be up for that?" And he was like, "Well, you know, I work on all the works myself. I think that's really important. So, no." And then the conversation kind of went dead. And then he's like, "But what kind of work do you do?" And from there we like developed like probably one of my most cherished relationships that I've had in the art world.
Wow.
And he was so great. Like I'd go to his studio. We'd go to art shows together. He showed me a lot of techniques with like using a drill press as like a lathe and a lot of like tricks for making things do what you want them to do, what you envision them to do, and ways that like, I mean, even in the machining world, now that I'm an engineer, I see how real people do it and they still don't do anything like him, you know?
Right.
I always think of his, I was asking him, like, well, how do you use gears and how do you find gears to make like a motor turn something else? And he was like, he said for one sculpture he wrapped corduroy around two like cans, and the corduroy became the gears. And I remember kind of being floored by that.
So this was kind of the beginning of your engineering nerd out,
perhaps. Totally.
Art/engineering nerd out.
That's true, yeah. Right.
So of those people, would you say there was one most instrumental in helping you get like a studio visit from Doug Christmas? How would you say that worked?
Well, I'm not exactly sure. Doug came to my MFA show, and I'm sure it was a combination of John Millay and Tim Hawkinson that were talking me up or something.
Right. Yeah. Was the work in your MFA show similar to the work that you showed in the gallery?
Or? Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So let's just briefly kind of encapsulate for people, which we can, you know, put up a link to your some of your videos. But basically, they're sort of multimedia video plants, engines and whatnot, and a plant that sort of sways back and forth, that kind of thing. Was, by the way, I'm sorry to make a drop a name here, but was the how did the rotating or shifting plant fall in the arc of Charles Ray's sort of moving objects?
Oh yeah, I'm a huge fan of the of that table that has those rotating things in his rotating wall piece.
Right.
Yeah, I suppose it does kind of. I remember realizing he's like a surrealist, where like you look at his work and then you realize that things are not as they seem, and it kind of shakes your world. And I really love that method. I don't think my work was as subtle. I think like you knew something was up way before you walked, you know, walked into it.
Right. Yeah. And I'm glad you said that, because I think that brings up one of the self-examination questions that I want to ask you, which is, when you look back on that work now, or even for several years since now, how do you view it?
Well, it still like interests me, but I kind of feel like I need to start talking about like my whole life with my father to kind of contextualize the whole thing, the way I actually see the whole thing going down.
Well, let's work backwards then.
Okay.
So tell everybody what happened, basically. You had this show, and then it was over. You want to just sort of give the sort of chronology of that situation?
Sure. So, yeah, I had a show with Ace that was probably up for, I don't know, 6 or 8 months, the way normally things are there.
It starts out being planned for like a month and a half, and then it ends up being like 6 to 8 months kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't remember how. I don't think we even talked about an end date in the beginning.
Right.
And then...
And what month did it open? It was 1999. So we're talking 15 years ago now.
Man, I don't know what month that was. That was...
First part of the year or latter part of the year, would you say?
Probably more end of the year.
Okay, so you crossed over into 2000 while the show was up.
Good chance of it, yeah. Hard to remember.
Okay. Yeah. Those details maybe are not incredibly important right now. But so what happened when the show ended? Or how was the reception too?
Well, I got a bad review in the LA Times.
Okay, good start.
Yeah, which like a lot of friends were like, "Oh, that's good." You know, they're such a conservative paper. That
from who was it?
It was
Christopher Knight, David Pagel.
No, David Pagel taught it. Claremont.
Okay,
we were friends. Yeah, Olaf.
Oh, Leah Ullman.
Yeah,
Leah Ullman. Okay, that's right. Yeah. Who?
Yeah.
Leah, you're welcome to come on the show, but I think you are known as one of the more conservative LA Times critics. Hmm. Anyway.
Well, thank you for that review, Leah.
Was there any, do you think you got more traffic from the review, though, at the gallery?
I don't know. I mean.
I guess that brings up the point that from what you sort of originally told me about the whole experience, you were not getting a lot of sort of updates from the gallery. Is that correct?
So when we started, like, it was at my MFA show, which was like a real success. And it was maybe a day or two after that, Doug called me and said, hey, I think we could work together. And I was like, wow, great. You know, this was totally my dream come true. And he wanted to get a show going right away, but I went to Skowhegan. And so I was like, okay, well, we'll do one when you get back. So when I got back and we were planning the show, he just took like a ton of interest in me and was calling me every day, and like, and it was amazing. You know, I was like, this is my dream coming true. That this is the gallery I've always wanted to show in. Every show I've gone to there, I've enjoyed, and I always felt like his taste was just spot on, and I mean, I still think his taste is awesome, you know, but also in conjunction with that, everyone who was not him said, watch out for that guy, you know, and he's going to screw you and it's going to be terrible, but do it anyway. So it was a real, I didn't have any tools for navigating it. You know, it was like, it was being in a ship lost at sea and it started out very sunny and it was amazing. He was calling me every day with like new ideas, new thoughts. I can't really remember the details, but I remember like him waking me up with a phone call and saying, wakey, wakey, you know? And me being like, wow. This is kind of weird. And, but great at the same time, because I didn't know who he was, and
nobody did, right?
Yeah, I think I probably still don't.
Did you powwow with Tim about that whole situation?
Yeah.
What did he have to say?
So this is why I want to. I mean, when things took a turn, Tim was the first person to say to me, "Well, he's not going to be your daddy," and I was like, "Wow!" Like, and that led me to actually track down my father in Israel.
Oh my God! Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's get to your father in a second, but maybe we should finish this arc and then we can move over to that arc.
Sure.
So Tim says he's not your daddy, which in some cases could be a good thing, but in this case, maybe it wasn't, because at one point he's saying wakey, wakey, and then the next day he's saying what?
Well, so yeah, as we set out to sea, he just had a lot. I mean, he wanted to direct the whole thing, you know, and he had ideas for how the artwork should be shown. And they actually really conflicted with the way I thought it should be shown. And, but in the beginning it was kind of like, okay, you know, you're in charge. This is your amazing thing. Like, let's go with this. And as it progressed, like more and more things disagreed with me until finally, I think we had a big blowout over the final room in the show. And there was a, what was it? It was a bucket with soapy water in it. And there's a monitor that's floating in the bucket. And it's me swimming.
In a river.
In a lake.
Right.
Actually at Skowhegan. Swimming in a lake. And then the pattern on the water in the video matches the bucket, because there's a little fan that's blowing on the water in the bucket. And I also had this collection of photographs of astronauts on vacation, where I wrote to all, what was it, like 350 US and Canadian astronauts and asked them to send me vacation snapshots of them on vacation. This, you know, and I put together this like package with letters of recommendation and, you know, sent it all out. And I got like 16 or so photographs back and blew them up. And there was this one photo of an astronaut and his son kind of sitting by a little lake. And I just thought it was perfect next to this other piece of mine. But Doug, I mean, after so much fighting, I finally took a stand on this one and said, like, no, I really think they need to be together. And he was like, you know, if you want to show it that way, find another gallery. And I was just like, whoa, like, you don't tell me to find I want this to work. I love you, you know. it's such like a dating thing, like,
wow,
like, no, it's what I'm doing is good too, you know. And really,
how did you feel when, you know, he gave you that sort of ultimatum?
Oh man,
was that like your first sense of, you know, maybe the dream being less than it seemed?
The dream started becoming like a nightmare, because it wasn't going my way probably halfway through the installation,
right,
where I was realizing, like, actually, my friend David Katsifrakis said to me, he noticed that I was like withdrawing and not happy with the way things were going as I was doing the installation. And he was like, you know, something's weird with you. he was saying, you've got to make this fun for you. Like, this is your show. This is like your thing. You've got to make this fun. Like something's totally wrong, you know? And it was that input that was like, he's right. You know, like, why am I following this guy's idea when like I've done well, I know how to seduce an audience or, you know, make it interesting, or it's more, what would I want to see if I walked into this show and I wasn't the artist, you know? I feel like that's the way I would normally approach a show. But this was the first time that someone else was, you know, calling the shots. And
so he basically assumed full control of installation decision-making.
Yeah.
Did you ever ask Tim by any chance, like, what their dynamic was when it came to that?
Yeah, which was very different. But, I mean, he's, you know, a much different relationship and makes...
So in a way, he was your daddy, actually.
Yeah.
So that statement was wrong.
Well, Tim was correct because I put Doug as well as, like, every man of power in my life as a father, if they'd let me.
Right.
And so...
Because your father was out of your life.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry to tease you and people listening, but we'll get to that. I just want to sort of finish this arc. So the show goes up. Are you already sort of a little disillusioned at that point?
Oh, so once the show was like open to the public... Oh yeah, that actually I had like a Doug like convinced me to cancel the opening, and I decided to have, I was like, well, you know, my birthday's coming up. That's right. It was December. It was the end of 99. So I was like, could I have like a birthday party there or something and invite some people and kind of make it an opening? And he was like, sure. And so I had this kind of like private opening, but it wasn't like sponsored by the gallery. I don't even think Doug showed up. And so it was like I got to have a celebration with my friends there, but even then, yeah, I was hurting. It was like, this is good, but it's not as good as it should be, you know?
Yeah.
And I think even at that point, I think Doug had kind of like given up on me in a way and been like, he like went to his other gallery in Mexico or something for a long time.
Wow.
And yeah. So
do you think it probably was gradual, but do you think when you tried to sort of push back with the installation, do you think that was the beginning of the end, or had it already happened?
No, I think it is. I think if I had let him call it was creative control that was the issue.
Right.
Which, and if I had been like, you're the gallery, you're allowed to show it how you want, that I would have probably stayed with him a lot longer.
So was there anything then, once the show ended, of note that happened?
Well, actually, I was a total dick to him. I said, like, so what's going on? Nothing sold. You were gone forever. Like, I kind of, like, confronted him on it.
You called him, yeah.
Yeah, and... I think he responded by saying, well, maybe we'll do a show in New York for you or something. And I was like, okay, that's cool. Like, all right. Like, I'm on board. And then, it was a few days later that he just called me and said, we're not working together anymore. I'm sorry.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was he nice about it?
He was just really business, cut and dry.
And so before we get to your father, still yet again, how would you say that took your art career, you know, next?
Oh. Well, it was kind of like a big reset switch after that. So after being told that, after Tim telling me that he's not going to be my daddy, I decided to look into who my father was. And I knew there was something weird about this whole thing and that it definitely related to my father. And so, yeah, I kind of just dropped out and found him and met him. And then after I met him, my whole, like, I didn't care about the art world as much anymore. My passion for showing the world the way I see things was just not really strong. And that was really a bit like the motivation before. It was like, I've got to show the way I see these things to people. And I usually got good response from it.
Do you think it was like having a kid where your whole perspective changes? Was it a little bit like that? Or was it maybe a different kind of experience?
That's an interesting question, because that's probably, after having had a kid, that's probably a good analogy, except that mine was much less gradual. Like, you have 9 months to see this thing growing, and I mean, every day you kind of are like, oh yeah, that's how a child, that's how we learn to pick something up. Like, I didn't realize that that's something you have to learn, you know?
Right.
And the way that perspective change happens over a much longer time, and that's why people are probably still having children.
Right, because it happens gradually and they don't, yeah. So backstory, where are you from originally?
I was born in Long Island.
Long Island. Did you grow up in Long Island?
Not really.
Okay, where'd you grow up?
We moved to San Diego when I was really young, and then a couple years in Chicago, and then back to San Diego, and then undergrad in Santa Cruz, grad school in L.A.
Right.
Ace Gallery, Israel, back to New York. And then in New York, I decided to take some engineering classes.
Why were you moving around so much growing up?
Oh, my mom split up with my father in San Diego, remarried, and he was living in Chicago. And then he started his own business in San Diego. And then...
Right. So that explains the moving. So, and what about your dad once he split with your mom? What happened to him?
Good question. I think I'll never quite have that completely answered. But my father came out as being gay when I was around 2 or so, or probably a little bit older, because I moved. It was when we were in San Diego. And he just couldn't handle what happened with coming out after being gay. And
did he come out to you as a toddler?
No. Well, if he did, I don't remember. But actually, I think my mom told me that he said, well, I like men and that's different. Or that maybe he did tell me something as a toddler, but he's definitely made several mistakes. But his coming out, he was a psychiatrist, and his coming out, I think, just made him feel like he was a scandal, and he kind of couldn't handle what people thought of him. And he ended up moving to New York, and then he'd make a couple appearances in my life as I grew up, but I'm sure my mom didn't make it easy for him to re-enter our lives. But her perspective is that he should have tried much harder. And
well, what I'm wondering is, to what extent was the discomfort of his coming out based on family life, you know, and trying to sort of live these two worlds? Or was it more simply just the challenge of, you know, coming out as gay? Or was it both?
So I don't quite understand the two worlds of living as a father.
Well, I should contextualize, because I've heard a number of radio stories from mothers or father, or men or women who led these double lives, where they stayed in their relationships,
right,
but were, you know, transgender, right, or they were gay and they held on to the secret from their kids, you know, these various kinds of dynamics.
Right.
But it sounds like with your dad, it was more, you know, I'm fully coming out and now that people know I'm gay, or maybe that and just being gay is like, it's a huge, you know, it's a gigantic shift that I don't know what to do with.
Yeah. As I understand it, like, he started kind of acting on his gay tendencies, and And it, I think it slowly kind of unraveled until he finally admitted, you know, my mom was asking him, what's going on? And he finally admitted that, yeah, he was gay. And I think then after that, it was like, so how are we going to do this? What's going on? And he didn't have a plan. And I think his, I know it didn't go very well after that.
so you have this conversation with Tim Hawkinson, who says, Doug Christmas is not your daddy.
Yeah.
The show ends. You reconnect with your dad. How did that work?
Well, we began on the phone, and
so your mom was still in touch with him, sort of?
No, I had her dig up old memories and people that for me to look up. And
so you got to him through a friend of his?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember what steps I took to get to him, but one day he just called me out of the blue, and I was not expecting it. And yeah, I was like, I'm not ready to talk to you yet, but like, give me some time. And then he just called every night. And in the beginning it was like, oh, okay, here's this guy. And I kind of like, somehow in the back of my mind, I always imagined that he'd be there for me when I was ready or something like that. And I was like, okay, this is this time in my life, and he's now going to be there for me. And then it wasn't until I started, probably a week after just cordial talking and understanding what he did now, because he's living in Israel as a Hasidic Jew. Yeah.
Oh my God.
You guys didn't see these eyebrows shoot up.
Well said. Can you give us the short version of how he went from gay coming out man to Hasidic Jew?
Gosh.
Seven words or less.
I don't know.
Well, yeah. Did he go to Israel as still being an out gay man? And did he hide his gay identity to the Hasidic community?
That's a good question, because I asked him, are you still gay? And he said, my gay tendencies have been rechanneled towards God. And then he also had gotten remarried to a nun who converted to Judaism, and then they got a divorce, but he didn't.
Was that in Israel too?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's definitely not a linear.
Should we get him on the mic?
Hey, Dad.
Yeah. Has he been back to the States?
I don't think so. I don't think he really likes the States. He lives a very rigid, structured life. I asked him, do you trust yourself? And he said, I try not to. So it seems like he's living a life that's dictated by the Bible. And because of that, he knows he won't screw up or something like that. And it's really strange.
So you went to go visit him, right?
Right.
Did you stay with him for a while?
No, actually, we were fighting over the phone for a while. And then I decided to take a trip to Israel and Iceland. And I almost thought, like, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to see him. Like, we're fighting. This is just bullshit. And my psychiatrist said, if you're in Israel and don't see him, you'll regret it for the rest of your life. I was like, eh, you're probably right. So once I got to Israel, I phoned him and said, I'd like to see you. And I said to him, I was like, you know, to my shrink, I said, what do I say to him? You know, where it's like, there's nothing. He's just coming off as an asshole now. And he said, well, you know, we came up with the idea of asking him, you know, you had a family and two kids, like what happened, and you were like a successful psychiatrist. How did you unravel? It seems as though like your life really unraveled, and like what happened? And I presented him that question, and he was just like, I couldn't answer that. You know, like that's something I probably even couldn't tell a psychiatrist. I would take, you know, And so at that point I was like, well, maybe I should just leave, like in my head. But I was sort of like, all right, well, I guess I should see how this goes. And he kind of took me around the Hasidic community and seemed to sort of be ushering me around and saying, like, you know, if we had grown up here, things would be good. Like, the children here are happy. And, like, isn't this great kind of thing? And this is where I studied Torah. And this is where everyone argues about the interpretations of the Torah. And, yeah, it was a really bizarre, like, moment. And then finally we got back to his place. And I had said, you know, if we're going to have a relationship, this has got to be, it sounds like you have just been really dishonest with people in your past about how you felt. And if we're going to have a relationship, you're going to have to, be more honest with me. And, he like just said, what do you mean if we have a relationship? And I can't believe you're saying that. You don't know how that's, and he ended up just getting more and more angry and kicking me out eventually. And that's kind of that's really the last I spoke to him. We exchanged one letter, but he kind of wrote like lyrics to the play Oliver, like never before as a boy wanted more and you want more from me. And like, it's kind of this
wow
lyrical thing. And
so he's not a real self-examined person, I take it.
That'd probably be a good way to put it, yeah.
And you kind of are.
Right.
Yeah.
Every step, probably.
To what extent did he kick you out? I mean, did he say, all right, you should probably pack up tomorrow and get a plane out of here?
No, I mean, I wasn't staying with him. I was staying with a friend, and I saw him for the day. He actually didn't even know where I was staying. But
so you already, you were keeping kind of a comfortable distance.
Right.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. then, yeah, he just said, if you're going to keep talking about this, like, leave. If you want, if you're going to stay, if you want to learn the Hebrew alphabet, you can stay.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So what was the takeaway then? You know, here you were lured to your father, you know, from this kind of experience and from this comment. And obviously it was a big disappointment, I would imagine, right?
Yeah.
What do you think the ultimate takeaway was?
But from that was the first time I, like, was not, like, in this delusional confusion anymore, you know? And it was the first time that I was, like, I don't know, recognized who I was, I guess, and where I came from. And
right.
And
how far you'd come, perhaps?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember, like, right after that, just wanting to prove to myself that I could do whatever I wanted. And, there's a mountain. I'm going to climb it, you know. And I went to Iceland right after that and really took advantage of climbing mountains there and such.
Nice.
And then...
to what extent... did, though, now you have this perspective on art and the art world, but to what extent did still that disappointing experience with the show and the gallery and the dealer give you a blanket sort of your view, you know, of that world?
Well, it's I feel like there's two answers to that question, because right after I was just... you know, fine turning my back on it, like proving to myself I could do whatever I want. Didn't care about making it in the artwork the way I did prior. But the second answer would be now, looking back on it. And I think this might answer another question that you're saying, is that almost all the work in that show, whenever I see it, like, when I go through the videos, it all just says so loud to me, like, who is my father and like what am like and what is this confusion that I'm in because I don't know my father. And I see it in like so as clear as possible. It's like And in a way, I kind of have to thank Doug Christmas for showing my work in that way so that I could see that so clearly.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a really healthy way to look back on that experience.
Well.
It's very enlightened of you.
I mean, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, everybody but you would be going shit, you know, and like bitter as hell, you know?
Well, I had my moments, but...
But you went through them.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Came out the other side.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've been doing engineering for, you know, what, a good decade now or more?
Yeah, I guess so. So part of like proving to myself that I could do whatever I wanted was like I could get an engineering degree if I wanted. And I ended up taking some calculus classes at Columbia as a post-degree non-major student, which is kind of this amazing backdoor way of getting into Columbia.
Wow.
And then,
what kind of engineering have you done basically over the years?
Let's see. I guess straight out of, well, while I was in college, I worked, or in Columbia, I worked with a startup medical robotics group that we were making a robotic scrub nurse called Penelope. And it was a robot that would hand you the doctor instruments during an operation. And it seems like they're still working on it. And that was really interesting. And then my first full-time job, I moved to Maine. And there's all this weird automation in Maine. And I got in with this automation company. And they built... They like did custom machinery for assembling stuff on a large scale, and I was a programmer, just programming robots and computers to assemble
is
stuff.
Is that a lot of zeros and ones, or is it a little more complicated than that?
Oh yeah, it's a higher language.
What
than
languages?
That.
Just to give people a general sketch.
I guess my programming is generally in what's called ladder logic, which is like there's this. It's called a programmable logic controller, and they're used everywhere. You've probably heard of, have you ever heard of Allen Bradley?
Rings a vague bell,
maybe? Yeah. They're like a huge company. They sponsor like, I think there's like a Formula One car that's sponsored by Allen Bradley or something, but anything industrial, like every, we were just on the gondola in Palm Springs. Like
the tram, right?
Right. That's anything where like a computer's controlling people that could, and it could die. Like you could die. There's definitely a PLC in there making sure you don't.
Nice.
Yeah. And like robots as well. Like
right.
They move really fast and can kill you. And so there's a lot of safety involved with.
Got
PLCs.
It. It's a very noble profession indeed.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying not to kill people with technology.
So then the postscript is that you are going to be participating in this art show. What is it? Sometime still this spring or is it the summer?
So it should be in September. And
okay.
It's at Campbell Hall High School. Or I guess they're like K through 12, I think.
Right.
But it's
organized by?
By Joe Sola, who's running the gallery there.
Right.
And it's like this tremendous space, and it's beautiful. And
what kind of piece are you going to do?
I'm still deciding, but I think I might do a car wash that you can walk through that has all the cleaning things inside are like silk plants, so like spinning trees and ferns and such, and so sort of like a jungle car wash thing with fake plants, probably.
That sounds awesome. You might want to hook up with Richard Jackson. When I visited his compound, he had just bought like one of those car wash armatures.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Huh.
I don't know. You know, he was going to do some kind of paint explosion kind of thing,
huh.
But you know, maybe I mean it's probably very heavy and I, you know, might be a little bit much for what you're doing,
right?
But maybe you can get some information from him. I don't know.
Yeah,
he would
be
willing
on
to cooperate.
eBay. That'd be cool. You'll have to give me his contact.
Yeah, either. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Oliver, you've been very forthcoming, honest, noble of talking about your story. So,
well, thank you.
Yeah. Did I leave anything out?
I hope not. I
Well, of course, I left many things out. But I mean, as far as this arc, feel like we're good?
I think we did good.
Great. Thank you so much.
You got it.
All right.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for being here. And we're out.
Bye-bye.